story, so I'll give you both.
Fine.
And Shakespeare was quite shocked by that, and he said, but how do you feel about the Shah? And I said, I think the Shah is the best leader that Iran can have at this present time, but that it would be a terrible mistake to think that he's either perfect or God, and that he has some weaknesses. And Shakespeare said, well, for example, what do you mean by that? And I told him the following story that had been told to me by one of my CIA contacts there, about a young American an American businessman who'd gone out to contract business there, and when the contract was finally signed, he was dealing with a young bushy-tailed reformist minister, and there was a sort of reception at which he was to be congratulated. They were celebrating the signing of his contract, and the young minister came up and was talking to him, and the businessman reached into his pocket and drew out a small envelope, and he said, by the way, I wanted you to have this. And the minister looked very shocked. He said, what is this? And he looked inside, and there was a lot of money. And he said, this is, do you realize I could cancel the contract on the basis of this alone? And the businessman said, calm down, just a minute. Look, I don't give away money. It's not my business to give away money. I try to earn money. He said, I didn't give you this money because I felt like it. I gave you this money because I was told to give you this money. And I was told to give you this money, to be exact, by General What's-His-Name, and you know who tells General What's-His-Name what to do. And Shakespeare looked absolutely stunned. He said, well, what do you mean? What does that story mean to you? And I said, I think it's probably true that the Shah has consistently managed to get evidence that he can hold over the heads of every political element in this country, so that if he needs to, he can call in his chips. He can fire the man, accuse him of corruption, anything you like. He's consistently tried, therefore, to corrupt his own political class. Shakespeare absolutely dropped his fork. He couldn't believe it. He said, a man like that couldn't even conceive of doing a thing like that, well, and so forth, and went off in a Boy Scout peroration that I couldn't believe. And I just, all I could do was just turn my hands up and say, well, the way it is. And he was no friend of mine after that, I must say, but I mean, the notion that the Shah rode a white horse and wore sparkling silver armor and was the god to his people and all the rest was absolutely baloney. And I was trying to explain to Shakespeare that if we dealt on that basis with the Shah, we were making a horrible mistake. Now, in terms of how that affected my program, my behavior, absolutely not at all.
How much change or continuity do you see in the next administration's general approach towards Iran at this time, even though it's having an impact on your work? What do you see in the way of changes in policy, continuity or discontinuity, and policy approach towards the Shah?
The basic posture of being, as it were, supporters in bed with the Shah did not change. The question that changed was very simple, to boil it down to one phrase. Meyer did not give the Shah everything he wanted, and MacArthur did. MacArthur was uncritical in his approach to the Shah, and Meyer was very cautiously critical. And if the Shah asked for F4s, Meyer would say, well, I'm not sure you can absorb F4s at this time. And that was the way the game was played. Now again, I wasn't sitting in on these conversations. I don't know how that game was played up there. But my impression was that Meyer was critically and correctly leaning against the Shah's wilder tendencies, while MacArthur, who had the intellectual depth of a Goebbels, was not really concerned with that. His policy was to support the Shah. The Shah was our man. As he used to say, this whole arc across the whole Middle East, he would gesture on the map, is an island of stability because of us. It's holding together because of this one man. Therefore, we must not in any way criticize him. That was a way of reducing the Shah to a ninny. The Shah was better than that. The Shah could take criticism if it were done in terms that he understood, and that the Shah could understand things like that. He wouldn't know. He was undereducated. He'd never had the benefit of living in a democracy other than the Swiss one. But aside from that, he wasn't fool by any means. A smart fellow.
you have much contact with MacArthur during your, as you did your job with cultural affairs office?
As little as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, he would invite me to the residence once in a while, and I was on duty. The two or three parties I went to had the same people. He was very much guilty of the invite the same people syndrome, and I really usually resented having to spend my time at one of those parties because it was a waste of time. So I had very little to do with him, and I preferred it that way. The DCM at that time was a man named Douglas Heck, and Doug was very carefully. He was a very sensible man. He's a very cautious man. He's not a very dynamic man, but he was a very good man, all things considered. And he had leaned on me and Lois for his early contact lists, and we had helped him break out of that circle so that he was able to do some, make some difference. But it was a long period with MacArthur. Well, I don't remember, 2 years, I guess, for me. And I just didn't see him that often. And I preferred it that way.
In his new book, James Bill suggests that there were occasions when the cultural affairs section and the information sections at USID worked at cross purposes. And in one instance being a 1970 magazine article on Princess Ashraf as a quote unquote patroness of human rights. Apparently the article alienated a group of young intellectuals that you were trying to court and develop at that time. Do you recall this episode?
It's funny, the episode doesn't stick in my mind at all, at all. The only thing I can imagine, it was in a magazine we used to put out every month, which was kind of a picture magazine, mm-hmm. articles, and I sat on the committee that decided what went into that magazine, but by and large the magazine was so boring that I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I had always assumed nobody worth anything read it, and you know, I used to go to the meetings, and they were foolish articles about how well the United States is doing in this and that. And every once in a while, we had an article, for example, on Goodrich Rubber or whatever it was, and some local investment and aid follow up and so on. So I didn't find it very interesting, and I didn't really bother with it. And it may have slipped through, but I don't remember the episode at all. It's entirely plausible. I can only say that. Ashraf represented, of course, a very ambivalent question. One of her key people was a man named Manuchehr Ganji. Ganji was, among other things, dean of the law faculty, later minister of education. He had a lot of important jobs. He's now in Paris on one of the opposition teams. And Ganji was a person who had come back from the University of California. He was a very early returnee, and he was, in fact, in charge of the Center for International Affairs at the University of Tehran, and so I had to be a contact of Ganji. I thought he was a strange fellow, but he was an important person to know, so I kept in touch with him. But he was a disciple. He was an amanuensis of Princess Ashraf. And another person who worked with Princess Ashraf was Afkhami's wife, Mahnaz, who was later the first woman minister of women's affairs in Iran. So you couldn't really say Ashraf was not a part of the picture. On the other hand, there were all these stories about her, which we all knew. I would not have, thinking about it now, been very happy about an article on Ashraf, but it may have slipped through. I just don't remember. But when you say at cross purposes, when he says that, it's entirely possible that it could be conceived that way. The information section was very independent from me. I didn't bother with them. They were working at a level of triviality and so forth. They worked with daily press releases and stuff like that. They were working with the ephemeral and the immediate. And for the most part, they were shoveling out stuff that came out of the wireless file every day. And it was all right. It didn't make any difference. I thought it was irrelevant as far as I was concerned. And I was annoyed that, 90% of the human resources in USIS went into that effort. And I was concerned about it, but it wasn't my shop, and the way I made my peace with it was to let it go its own way. Now, I was the one, on the other hand, that was doing things that might have been considered by that shop very offensive, but nobody ever bothered me about it. We published a magazine called Renew, the idea, which was the returnees from the United States. And that magazine was really very interesting cutting edge. They published it religiously. They put it out. They printed it beautifully. They did everything we said. Never asked any questions about the content, just simply were delighted to be part of this. So I never ran any trouble with them. They didn't bother me, I didn't bother them. But it's possible that sometimes we may have seemed to speak at cross purposes. The basic cross purpose of USIS is embodied, of course, in those two differences. On the one hand, there's the short-term, immediate news kind of thing. On the other hand, there's the long-time intellectual context sort of thing. So in many ways, we were dealing at cross purposes in structural terms. But in terms of the output, I don't think we were that far off the mark. I mean, when I get to that part of Jim Bell, I'll treat it critically, but offhand, I think that there was more harmony than may have met the eye. If I expressed irritation more than once to people within the bounds of loyalty, Jim may have been one of them. It was that the information effort was so enormously dominant in the operation in terms of the resource allocation. We could have taken that money and spent it in tremendously important ways. But it was going down into some of these silly things, most of which served to make the people in Washington feel that they were relevant in some way. Fix up the big egos.
Okay. Now, you alluded to this question at time, various times throughout the interview, but while you were stationed in Iran, how much did the country change, and in what ways did Iran change while you were living there?
Boy,
this, well,
I was there a long time.
You said, your first 4 years were pretty pleasant.
Okay.
The last year was relatively unpleasant. What was going on in Iran that reflected that perception?
Let's forget about the economic changes, the building, the growth, the formation of new universities, the progress, and all of that stuff. I mean, things were really bubbling. I couldn't begin to tell you what was going on.
Yeah.
But when I made that statement, I'm referring really to two things, three things. One was information flow. Two was downward delegation. And three was the toleration of a certain amount of carefully posed dissent. On all three counts, in my judgment, the period from 66 to 70 was an opening period. There was just much more toleration, discussion, openness than had ever been before. Now, I have to say that any American wandering into it said, what's all this openness you talk about? It doesn't look open to me. Well, it's a contextual openness. It's much opener than it was before. I might even list a fourth thing. There is considerable evidence that I'm right in this, but I had the impression that at a certain time during the period I was there, the use of torture literally ceased by Savak. And this was later confirmed by an Iranian at the high levels who said that there was a 2-year period in which they simply stopped torturing. It was a matter of policy. Under the, I think it was Pakravan who was the head of Savak for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then when, I guess it was Nashiri came back in, it was back to the old game. But all of that, you see, was happening in that period from 66 to 70. There was, for example, a visit from Amnesty International at that time, went into the prisons, political prisons and so forth, and came out and was really quite surprised to find what she had found. And in other ways, there were, you know, the famous Wolf Ladejinsky, who had been the great agricultural reformer of Taiwan and places like that, came through and really had a very great surprise when he saw that agricultural reform in Iran was really more or less, with all its problems, working. There was a lot of sense that everything was going to work. And from 66 to 70, there was this period of real true optimism where we all kind of felt we would make it. And then in 70, 71, he lost his nerve, as I've always said, and cracked down. There were a whole bunch of signs that came that year. And when I left, I was really very, very discouraged, very gloomy. And then Lois's letters the following year only confirmed this. It got considerably worse. There was a lot of breakup going on.
What were some of the signs that you perceived?
The Siakal business up on the Cape that I'm up in the Caspian that I mentioned before. The big one to me was the bust of the Arya Mare University student disturbances, where the police were unbelievably violent. I mean, violent beyond any need to be violent. And that just indicated that something had gone wrong, because that kind of violence was wrong. There were very interesting elements of what you might call Islamic Puritanism Jim Bill's wife. I told Jim Bill once, he'd completely forgotten it. Jim Bill's wife, wearing short sleeve dress, sleeveless dress, was roughed up by a bunch of youngsters on Tallahassee Boulevard and treated like a whore because she was improperly dressed that year. And there were a bunch of little bits of evidence. There was some transfers in the university that indicated they were less ready to be open in what they were doing, and so forth. There were, I remember Jim once read off a list of 11 things that happened in 70-71 at some conference over at FSI. And we walked out afterwards for coffee, and I remember saying to him, Jim, those are wonderful things, but there are six others that you could have listed. And I listed them, and the last one I said, and the other time, the one you've really forgotten is when your own wife was roughed up. Oh my God, I forgot that. So there were a lot of little evidences that year that something was wrong, that this kind of opening that we'd seen, the glasnost of its time, was being turned off.
Did you remember, were you there when they had, the Rockefellers had the investment seminar? There were mm-hmm. protests against that. I think their Ayatollah was, who protested, was later allegedly tortured and killed. The Ayatollah Saidi. I think Bill talks about this, but I think it's mentioned in other accounts.
Well, now my confusion is manifest. I read that section in Jim's book very lightly, and I resolved to go back and look at it again because I don't remember. But I know that the seminar that he talked about, if it was a seminar, was run by Jim Lennon of Time Life. And he brought out all these big fat cats. I remember sitting with the guy from Boise Cascade because I had a cousin who worked for that company. And the idea was to get a lot of fat cats to come out and invest. Now, I was not aware, I am not aware today, of any follow-up to that. I'm not aware of any protest. And I'm not saying it wasn't there, but it seems very strange that I would not have been aware of that. I'm not questioning it, but I just don't remember that. It's funny. My memory is peculiar. It is a little teeny bit selective. I do remember the bad things, it's true. But by and large, it's pretty good. So, I don't know.
Do these changes in the atmosphere have much... You mentioned the bombing of the U.S. the embassy or USIA offices at one point. Beyond that kind of an episode, did these changes in the atmosphere have much impact on your work in Iran?
On my work? Yeah. Zero. Yeah, absolutely, yeah, none. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely none. Absolutely none. Mind you, I'd always been properly cautious in what was essentially a closed society. I mean, I was dealing with Iran somewhat the way I would have dealt with the Soviet Union, very carefully. I mean, the assumption of phones being tapped was always there. Doesn't mean they were tapped, but you had to assume that maybe they were tapped, and so forth. So you were cautious about what you did on the phone and cautious about what you said and so forth and so on. And certainly I didn't want to get anybody into trouble and get them killed, so I was very cautious about information that I had, all of that. So I'd always been cautious and continued to be cautious. Maybe it affected my morale the last year, but I would say that was not, that didn't show up in the program in any particular way. In any case, the bomb that I was aware of was in the spring of 71, and the other bombs, all six of the other ones, all took place a year later. The attempted kidnapping of Douglas MacArthur was one that bothered the hell out of me, not because it had happened, but because our own bosses wouldn't tell us about it. We were told it had never happened.
Yeah, right.
And that irritated the hell out of me. I just didn't understand why we had to be treated like children, all of us. So, but no, it didn't touch my program at all, and I would guarantee it didn't touch Lois's program at all, except in one regard, and that's the famous play, which I may have told you about.
I'm not sure, no.
You got tape long enough?
Yeah.
Lois was very eager to have a Persian theater. We'd had, up to the time she came there, an American and English expatriate theater, which was very successful, and we'd involved occasional Iranian homes. But she was interested in getting the Iranians to use it. That means not only together to put on theater in English, but also to put on plays in Persian. And she was approached by a Persian theater group who wanted to put on a play which I think was called The School Principal, which may have been taken from Jalal Hassan's book, I don't know. I never saw it, by the way. In order for a play to be put on, it had to be passed by the censor. The censor passed the play, and the permission was given, and the play was put on it. It ran for 11 performances. The story was a loosely disguised story about authority. The school principal was the Shah, loosely speaking, and there was a lot of unrest underneath and people pitching about his behavior and all the rest. And it was a loose allegory, a loose political allegory, which didn't offend the censors, so it had to be acceptable. But there was one scene in the play in which something happens and everybody yells and screams all at once. And they were all yelling, and it was all written in this text what they're supposed to yell. Well, the story goes that as the performances succeeded, the first, the second, the third, when they got into about the seventh or eighth performance, the shouting at the at this climactic point of the play began to contain finally things that weren't in the script. And finally, the Savak closed the play. The accusation was that someone had yelled death to the Shah during that scene. And they closed the play. I have to say, probably from their point of view, it was the proper thing to do. And from the other side of the thing, I would have to say that the Iranian theater group was very irresponsible and foolish, and certainly kicked the Iran-American Society in the teeth for no good reason. The only thing that happened, Lois was called by the PAO, her boss, and was read a lecture about how this mustn't happen again. However, the boss in question allowed her to know by various signs that he was doing what he'd been ordered to do and that he was in full support of it. She responded in a deathless phrase. We'd been reading Gideon's Trumpet at that particular time. You remember the book about the guy who worked his way out of prison by his own legal efforts. And she said, look, I understand that you have to give me this talk, but I do want you to understand that the day that the Iran-American Society plays a role as Hoveda's trumpet, we are lost. We might as well close it. In other words, we cannot flack for the Pahlavi regime, is what she was saying. So many words, which is Jim's thesis, but he doesn't remember that episode. So that said, I think that obviously that had to be in the back of her mind as she went through her work. Obviously, she was not going to trust another theater company with a play that was that close to the margins.
How did you leave Iran?
I left Iran in June or July, I think it was July 13th, 1971. I spent the following year at Princeton, and I was in very active touch with Iran through the letters of Lois and through the fact that I was hanging around the Middle East Department at Princeton. People like Mauro Berger went out to Iran with my briefing and met Lois and so forth. So there was a lot of contact to and fro between me and Iran that year. I was, in touch with Iranian scholars, all of them. And so I was very much in a university context, so it was very appropriate for me to stay in touch. When I got to Washington the following year, I was put into the Division of Educational and Cultural Affairs, where I had really no inputs at all. I had nothing to say about Iran. I was, during that year, I was brought down to testify before the Board of Foreign Scholarships about developments in Iran, which was an interesting thing. Walt Rostow was on the board at the time, and so forth. And I did my number when called upon, but basically I didn't have much to do with it. I was thinking about writing a book about Iran that year, but the more I tried to do it, the more I realized that the language of social science would not carry it. It was simply something that I wasn't trained in. The historian couldn't really do it. Partly because there were too many things I knew that I couldn't attribute to sources, and finally because basically it was just too close. But when I got to Iran, to Washington, and then Lois came back that year, and we were very shortly married thereafter, our house became a kind of a center for visiting Iranians. And in 74 we were transferred to Rome, where it was even closer. We saw Iranians all the time. And the same was true in Paris when we got there in 78. Only it was a little sadder then, because by 78 the revolution was on, and what we were handling was really visa cases of people who came through, trying to help them get out. And we've never been far from Iran, as you see. I'm surrounded by it here in this living room, but We've constantly been in touch with Iranians. In fact, I just came back from Paris, and I ran into a whole bunch in Paris, and we had a good old evening together and so forth. So it was enormously, 5 years after all of your life, mm-hmm. It was a central experience in my life, and the Iranians knew that, and they constantly are with us. Formally, I've never really done anything about Iran. I was away during the revolution and the hostage taking. If I'd been here, I probably would have been on the task force. Many of my friends were, people like Robert Bemis and Bill Royce in the distance, mm-hmm. Ramazani and so forth, calling into Gary Sick and mm-hmm. so forth. But basically, my inputs were accidental, casual, and secondhand.
Mm-hmm. Any concluding observations you'd like to make on U.S.-Iran relations and your experience?
I think I've said it all too many times.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Thanks very much.
Okay. My pleasure.